can change your future.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about taxes. Not all taxes, but primarily income taxes, kind of like a late mid-year checkup. We do a late year checkup in December, but here to lead us in that discussion is Tom O'Rourke, attorney at law, partner.
Partner, yes.
Miles Stockbridge. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Bob. Thank you for having me.
That was a short intro because you're the one that got me into this.
Was that good or bad?
Many years ago. I know you took a very scared guy and led me by the hand in the first show. I was scared to death, and you just treated it like it was, you know, the microphone was in front of us, but we were two guys talking. And a scant, what, 30 years later, here we are doing it again.
I don't think it's been quite that long, but it's been a long time.
All righty. And John Elliott, federal benefits strategist, retired Fed, fellow seminar presenter, and so is Tom. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. And I'm Bob Lyons. I'm an accountant finance type, and we're going to talk about taxes, but normal taxes. We're going to try to stay out of the stratosphere. Let's do one of the easy things first, energy credits. I get emails oftentimes from both clients as well as through the show here. And I want to do this. Do I get an energy credit for it? Well, the energy credit is X dollars, depending on what you're going to do. And most of us look at that as a $1,500 credit, and that's equal to some percent of what you're buying. But it's a combination of 2 years, 2009 and 2010. So sometimes people forget that if they hit the max in 2009, they may do whatever they want in 2010, but there's no more credit. Or if they got a piece of it in 2009, then the residual between that piece and the $1,500 is what they could claim for 2010. And you just hear an awful lot on the air now about windows. I mean, there isn't a station that I listen to that isn't talking about do your windows by year's end and it qualifies for the credit, but they cover themselves. You check with your tax advisor. And windows can be replacement of windows, and it can be installation of new windows. It can be certain type of appliances, and it can be the more exotics, geothermal. Now, I don't think too many people are going to do geothermal, but correct me if I'm wrong, guys. I think what you do with geothermal is you dig down into the ground and you find water, and the water is at a constant temperature of, I believe, 55 degrees. It pumps back up into the house, and through a system of fans and whatnot, it'll cool you in the summer, and it'll keep you from freezing in the winter. Now, it's not your only heating and cooling system. You might need something more than 55 in the winter, but it augments it.
You've just described a lot more about geothermal energy than I ever knew.
All right, well, I get a lot of questions on it before I go. I thought, gee, this sounds exotic, and when you think about it, it is exotic, but it's not. Somebody comes in and drills down. Now, it's not inexpensive to do, but the tax credit is huge. It's 30% of what you spend, up to an awful lot of money.
Yeah, it is a lot of money.
And the payback period with the credit and the reduced energy cost may be 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm. What is the difference between, I always get them confused because I'm not a tax guy, as probably most of our listeners are not. What is the difference between a deduction and a credit?
Great question. Let's say you have a charitable donation of $100. Let's just say that. And you're in a federal tax bracket of, say, 25% and a state bracket of, say, 5%. So for every dollar you earn, you pay 30 cents at that point. Now, the listeners should be clear that to get to 25, you would have gone through lower brackets first, but you're always taxed at your highest marginal level. And again, let's just assume that's 25 plus 5 or 30%. And you make that $100 donation because it's tax deductible. Yes, it is, but it's a tax deduction, as you accurately pointed out, which means you save $30, 30% of the $100 you would save in taxes. Whereas if you had a $100 credit, that reduces your taxes $100. So it's 100% reduction.
So like a flexible spending account, which reduces your taxable income by how much you contribute, is a credit?
No.
No?
No.
It's okay. See, I'm still confused.
Okay, let's look at what happens with a flexible spending account. Because, again, these are good questions because I'm sure the listeners are saying the same thing. What are these people talking about? So let's talk about the FSA. And let's say that we can put $3,000 into our FSA out of our salary.
Right.
That's the key, out of our salary. So our salary is reduced $3,000. And you'd say, yeah, but I didn't get the $3,000. Well, it went over into a holding account for us to use for whatever we so desire within the constraints of the law, usually medical, where we would never be able to deduct it otherwise. But here, not only did we save the income tax, use the same example, 25% federal and 5% state, we'd save $900 on that, but we also save the Medicare and Social Security. Everybody's going to save Medicare that's listening. Social Security would be those in CSRS.
No, FERS.
FERS. Sorry. Thank you. See,
or
that's why you
offset.
Do what you do and I do what I do.
Right.
Okay. So it would be a pretty huge savings in that case if you stacked on top the 7.65 half of Social Security and Medicare on top of the 30% tax savings. That's 37.5%. reduction of our taxes on the $3,000, so it's going to be $1,100. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nothing that you claim anywhere, because remember, it comes right off the top of your salary. You don't report it. So if your salary was, say, $70,000 a year and you put $3,000 into the flexible spending account, the amount that shows up on your tax return is the $70,000 minus the $3,000 that you put into the flexible spending account.
So you're taxed on $67,000.
Exactly.
Yeah, but that's a deduction, you say.
Well, it works like a deduction. You don't get you don't get a $3,000 tax savings. You get $1,100, but it's none too shabby.
So the guy in my seminar last week was right. It is a deduction.
Yeah, yeah.
It was NASA. I don't know. Maybe they maybe they have tax accounts at NASA.
It's actually not even an adjustment. It just doesn't even show on the return.
It's got the same effect as a deduction, but that's one of the things that can confuse the heck out of people when they're talking to tax people. It's really an exclusion. It has the same practical effect for a normal person.
But I think to drill to the heart of it is, you don't save $3,000 in tax if you put $3,000 into it. If it was a credit, you would.
Mm-hmm.
But it's never going to be a credit.
It's still a good program.
It's a great program, and it's also something, as you pointed out, that the best you could do would be able to deduct it, but only if you had extreme medical expenses that weren't covered by your health insurance. And you wouldn't want to be in that position, but, you know, $3,000 isn't out of the norm for maybe an individual or a family to spend during the year on unreimbursed medical expenses.
Uh-huh.
So it not only does that, it saves a chunk in taxes. So thanks. Oh, good question. Hope the listeners picked up on that. Now, if the listeners are going, what are these guys talking about? You can call us. We're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. And I should remind everybody that it's about 10:15 a.m., August 30th, 2010. We'll be off the air at 10:58, August 30th. And after that, don't call, because we won't be on the air.
We'll
but
be
you
at
can
lunch,
email us.
Maybe. Yes.
Maybe we'll be at lunch, but we won't be here. And so then somebody could email us if they so desired, and we'll do the email in a little bit. But right now, phone 202-465-3080. So we talked a little bit here about the energy credits, and John picked up and said, what's the difference between a credit and tax deduction, or an exclusion or an exemption or something like that? Major difference. Right, Tom?
Absolutely. And I guess the really important thing is that for people who are thinking of taking steps to make their house more energy efficient, do it by the end of the year, because Uncle Sam will help you at least a little bit. And when I think of the energy credit, I don't think of geothermal. I think of some simpler things like new windows or a new door or insulation or things like that that'll help reduce your electric bill or your gas bill and will also help you save a little bit of taxes.
We had some blown-in insulation put in the attic, and it's unbelievable. As hot as it's been this summer, I don't think we've had an electrical bill over $275. And that wasn't the case before. And all it was very inexpensive to do, and they just came in and they blew it in, and it looks like a snowdrift upstairs. Only problem is I don't know where to walk now when I go up there because I don't want to walk through the ceiling.
You're right. Yes, you don't.
Tax code can't help you with that, Bob.
All right, but I'm gonna get a credit.
You're gonna get a credit.
All righty. So, I think we talked about the difference between energy credits and tax exclusion or tax exemption. Other credits that somebody might, and it's a stretch. That people would be available. Qualify for other type credits, and it's a little bit outside the norm. The caution flag here, of course, is if you haven't hit your max for 2009 and 10, you have until December 31st to do it. And it has to be installed by then. It can't necessarily be ordered by then. Okay?
Yes, sir.
Another thing that I think is crucial to year end, we've talked an awful lot about the voluntary contribution, and not to freeze out the FERS people because they can't do this. It would also be for Roth conversions. And a little change in the law such that people really need to be cognizant of this before December 31st, 2010. If they're going to try to move traditional IRA money into a Roth, then they want to clear out of the traditional IRA anything that would be taxable. Now, historically, people that have put money into traditional IRAs over the years either claimed it as a tax deduction or they didn't. But if they didn't and they put the money in, then that money certainly can't be taxed again. So what is taxable then would be the earnings on it or prior to the change in the law when somebody claimed a tax deduction for it. Somebody might say, well, how do you rid yourself of that? Well, there's a provision that you could transfer that money into the thrift savings plan. And so that you don't think I'm crazy, there is a form for this. It's a TSP 60. And the movement of that money between now and the end of the year is key so that at December 31st, 2010, the only thing left in the traditional IRA, relatively speaking, would be the non-taxable portion. Which, of course, if you moved it then into a Roth, you wouldn't pay any taxes on it. And it's a relatively simple procedure, but one that you really, really should start on no later than the end of November, early part of December. You've got to have that money washed out of there. If it makes a little money between that date and the end of the year, so you pay a tax on a very small portion.
Yeah, Bob, and I think this may be more a question for John, but isn't the ability to roll money into the thrift relatively new? I don't think that's always been the case with the thrift plan, or has it been?
It's been around for a while. The vehicle you use is Form TSP 60, and it's very easy to do. My wife and I just did it. So it's a relatively easy form to deal with, but also it's got very useful information as part of the form. Explaining, for instance, that the portion you can roll into the TSP is the portion of your earnings that has yet to be taxed, and which is what we did. I had to get what they call a cost basis from the mutual fund, and then figure out what had already been taxed and left that in the mutual fund, and moved the remainder, which thankfully was most of it, into the TSP. That's been around a while.
They've tightened it a little bit. You now have to sign it as an affidavit that the only money that you're moving into the TSP is taxable money, because they didn't want it to be mixed up with non-taxable money.
Right.
And
which
like
makes
you said,
sense. Yeah.
It makes sense, but people, I think, were unclear on what to do.
The TSP 60 explains that very clearly.
Yes, it does.
And as well as other things, is a very well-designed form, as most of the TSP forms are. So if you download that, go to tsp.gov, click on Forms and Publications, and obviously you'll go to Forms, and you'll easily find it, and you can print it out. And it's a very easy process. Once you determine the non-taxable portion of your conventional IRA, say, for example, or if you had a 401k at a company, to transfer it into the thrift savings plan.
Okay, and we should also remind people when doing this, it should be done in concert with an IRS Form 8606. We're not trying to snow you with form numbers here, but IRS Form 8606 would show what John mentioned, the basis. And without that form, you're asking for trouble, because it pretty much details what you're doing on the TSP-60. And on that form, it's a very simple form. The first three lines really deal with what's called basis. In other words, what is a basis? What did you put into your IRA or IRAs over the years that you did not get a tax deduction for? It's the first three lines, and it's very simple. Might be a little hard to reconstruct if one didn't file, although you're supposed to file every year that you put money into it. You don't have to file it if you don't put money into it. And this established, again, your basis, like John mentioned, and anything above that would have been wiped out and put into the TSP. The 8606 goes in, supports what you did, you're done.
Yeah, and where you can get this basis by calling your, say, if it's a mutual fund directly, or if you've got a broker, a financial planner that handles that, you can get it through him or her as well. So... And that you just hand to somebody like Bob, right? and takes it from there.
And I take it from there.
Now the, and you fill out the 8606 or something.
Yep. Right. I've been doing it for a while. The other thing, the 8606, if you go to the IRS website and pull it down, you're going to get the 2009 version. The 2010 is 4 or 5 pages. Not that you have to fill out 4 or 5 pages. But it deals with a lot of these Roth conversions that heretofore were really not an issue. And there's going to be an awful lot of that happening in 2010 and 2011. And I apologize, but there was a gentleman in Newport News, Virginia, a financial planning firm, and I'm really, I want to say Mike Mason, sent me the form in draft a few weeks ago. And I hope I didn't butcher the name, Mike. I got to give him credit for sending it to me.
Bob, why is it important to do this by year end?
If you don't do it by year end, the basis is established, and this is probably the first year, at December 31st, the year before you make the transfer. All right, so if you don't do it before, then when you look backwards, you got a mixed bag. You want the definition of what's in your IRA to be non-taxable. If you wait till after the end of the year, I'm not saying you can't do it. It's not as vivid, and there's just no argument. This is what it was. Here's my verification of it. Here's my 8606. Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
So that really what you're saying is the 8606 that you file as part of your 2010 return is going to establish what your basis is, and that's going to be the starting point for determining what you can convert into a Roth without paying tax.
You might get clipped a little bit. I mean, you can't do all this December 31st. So, you know, my feeling is you should start November 30th, December 1st, make sure that money gets into the TSP. Now, the remainder of the money that's in the IRA that we thought would be fully non-taxable is going to earn something, hopefully. Maybe it's a modest amount of interest. Let's hope it doesn't go down in the market. But we might get nipped, I should say, with a little tax, but none to stop you from doing this. But that's why it's so key. It's December 31st of the year that just passed before you make the Roth conversion.
Well, yeah. December 31st is also when the income limits for getting into a Roth were lifted for the entire year, right?
Last year, right. December 31st, 2009. So they were done away with in 2010.
So anybody could be in a Roth in 2010.
Yeah.
Because the income limits went away, but they do return in 2011, am I right?
No.
No?
Mm-mm.
Oh, and they made that permanent?
Well, they made it. They didn't say permanent. They said...
we'll get around. They just haven't done anything to...
That's right.
So if Congress doesn't do anything, then 2011, the income limits are still gone.
Yeah.
Okay. That I didn't know. That's the reason I asked.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't sure.
It was not clear, but if... I talked to a number of people like Tom, and Tom included, you know, is this stuff just going away for the year? And no one could say that it was. And the wording was the income restriction has been lifted. It didn't say for 1 year. It didn't say for 10 years. It didn't say till forever. It's just been lifted.
Well, speaking of Roth, and this is for either of you, who is a good candidate for a Roth as opposed to a conventional IRA or conventional 401k or TSP, and who isn't, if there is such a class of people?
I would dare say I'm really going to have to reach for this one, Tom, and you might want to correct me. You're probably going to correct me. If somebody had the ability to put money into a traditional IRA and claim it as a tax deduction, they'd get the tax benefit
right
from it. But then somebody would say, yeah, but when they take it out, then they'll have to pay taxes on it, most
right.
definitely. But if that person was relatively certain that at the time that they would be withdrawing the money, they'd be in a lower tax bracket because they'd have lower income, or they're moving to a state that doesn't have a state income tax, that person might well be better served with the deductible IRA.
Conventional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For many federal employees, though, they cannot deduct contributions to an IRA. So if you
right.
are a federal employee and you can't deduct your
right.
contribution to an IRA, then it always makes sense to put it into a Roth.
Yeah, and the reason for that is you've got a defined benefit plan, a pension.
Right,
yeah,
right.
That's why you can't deduct a conventional IRA. As you, at one time, I think you could, but in 86 when the that doesn't matter. Tax laws changed.
Prior to 87, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You could deduct it whatever your income was, yeah. and even if you are covered under a pension plan, whether it's the federal
FERS
or
CERS,
I guess it was CERS then, or it was FERS, right?
No, FERS was officially launched on 1/1/87.
Okay.
But, yeah, so.
Well, regardless, they were covered under one or
okay,
another,
yeah,
including the military, and somebody in private industry, the same rule. If they were covered under 401k or some decent pension plan or some minuscule pension plan, it knocked them out once the law changed. Prior to the law change, there was no restriction. It was interesting. You had to deduct it.
Yeah.
It wasn't a choice.
Now, last I heard, at the end of next year, 2011, the Thrift Savings Plan is going to come up with a Roth.
It's going to be a Roth, quote, 401k, end of quote. You know,
right.
the Thrift is not a 401k,
right.
but walks and quacks like one. I mean, it's the mirror image of it, but it's not housed in Internal Revenue Service Code 401k.
So what Tom is saying, because that would be something well worth looking at.
My guess is when the Thrift 401k option becomes available, many people are going to have to look at it very, very carefully. To decide, does it make more sense for me to put it into a deductible thrift plan or into a 401k, the Roth 401k or the Roth thrift where I can't deduct it, and that's gonna you're gonna have to deal with the issue that Bob just mentioned.
Yes, so
is it likely your tax bracket is going to be higher or lower after you retire?
I also think, if I could generalize, and we will have a system developed by then, and when we go to class, we'll walk through the people, so it'll cover everyone. But let's say somebody at a younger age isn't at their peak earning power. And so they say, well, I could forgo the tax deductibility of moving money into the thrift once they institute the thrift Roth. Because I'm going to get it in there and I'll forgo the tax benefit, but because I'm young, it's going to be able to compound and grow over many more years than my counterpart that's a little closer to retirement, that maybe is in a higher tax bracket because of their grade level, et cetera, years in service, then they would prefer to do that. So that's going to be part of it. And the other part is going to be how much are they going to have in retirement income? And I think by the time we start doing all this, we're going to be talking more to FERS groups than we are to CSRS groups.
That's right. So since the TSP is such a vital part of the FERS plan, and if you contribute the max every year or start doing the max as soon as you can for as many years as you can, obviously you'll be far more comfortable in retirement by a wide, wide margin than if you didn't. So those younger people starting out, correct me if I'm wrong, if they put it in a Roth, which comes out tax-free when they withdraw the money sometime after retirement, they'd even be better off?
I think so.
I think so. That's what it sounds like to me.
Well, let's look at it like this and clear some of the fog out of this. Let's say we have $1,000 to invest, and you can multiply this by whatever you want, and you choose to put it into a Roth or a traditional, whether it's 401k or IRA. It doesn't make any difference. Your investment choice with $1,000 isn't going to be any different. So that $1,000 is going to be invested at point A, and it's going to grow over the years. And at the end of the period of time, the money in the Roth 401k or the Roth IRA versus the traditional 401k or the traditional, there is going to be not one penny's worth of difference in the growth inside of that tax shelter. None. So at the end of the day, they're going to have the same amount of money. However, when the money went in, the one would have foregone the tax benefit to put the money in, so there's a tax benefit for that. But I think much more importantly, when the money comes out of the traditional IRA or their traditional 401k, it's going to be subject to tax at whatever rate that person might be, federal and or state, if applicable. And so it cuts down on the utility of the money coming out. But picture the growth over 5 years, 15, 20, 30. I think the ones further out have to say, I'll forego the tax benefit for the future value.
Yeah, for the tax-free benefit coming out in retirement.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. I think it sounds like it makes a lot of sense to do the Roth TSP option when it is launched.
Okay, now, I know from some of the emailers and the calls that I get, there's some people out there that can't get to their phone and say, you're wrong. As soon as everyone gets their money in there, they're going to change the law. They'll herd the cattle and then they'll ride them off the cliff. Well, let's say that they do. Let's just say that they change the law. I don't know, Tom. I think you and I go back further with this than we care to remember. But it seems to me every time they change the law for something that was attractive before, they don't ignore the fact that that money was in there for that period of time. So they say, for this amount of money at this date, we're going to put a benchmark there, and that will remain under the old law, but any new money is not going to get this.
Typically, that's true, Bob, that most tax changes tend to be prospective. In other words, they only apply to the end of the future. So if Congress does, and Congress already has, authorized 401k Roth, which is what is going to happen with the thrift next year, presumably it won't change the law. Could they? Sure. Congress can do just about anything it wants to, but they, if history is any indicator, they would not do it retroactively.
Oh, right. And then others are going to say, yeah, they're going to do that because next year in 2011, the tax rates are going to skyrocket. Well, they're legislated to skyrocket only because the legislation says if we don't do anything, they're going to go back to what they were prior to this substantial reduction of taxes. Who knows what's going to happen, but I sincerely doubt they're going to let those rates pop for everyone, because it's going to hurt the lower income and the middle income people more than it's going to hurt the higher income people. And nothing has really been proposed that you can point your finger at. There's a number of pontifications and whatnot. But one day I said, there's got to be a rate assumption somewhere. And I bet they did it when they did the budget for the coming year. So I Googled 2011 tax rates used in 2010 budget. Boom, out pops this website. And the website, and I'll forget all the WWWs, it's called Tax Policy Center. Tax is in tax, policy is in policy center, all one word, .org. And then / tax topics, / 2010. Okay. And out will pop the proposed budget that they used to generate the tax revenues that they thought would be coming in 2011. And it's amazing that the tax rates for the first, the lowest income individual, didn't change. Next level, didn't change. Next level, didn't change. Next level, didn't change. Fourth level actually had a decrease. And then at the highest level, the people really got hammered. But you're talking about people with taxable income. This is all their income minus all their deductions of $375,000 if they're single and or married and head of household, the same. So, I mean.
And, Bob, what's the dollar figure before that, the fourth level? It only affects people making income of more than how much?
It would be taxable income of as little as $192,000 up to $375,000.
Okay, so
that's taxable now.
The consistent. Most of the Republicans in Congress say we shouldn't do anything with the tax law, leave it as it is. The Democrats have said, well, we need to increase it for people in the higher bracket. So the only people who really need to get really concerned about this are people whose taxable income is more than $375,000.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the other thing to point out is how badly are they going to get hammered? What's that maximum tax rate going to be?
Well, it's going to be... let's say that it was 35%, and then it goes to 39.6, and who knows what they'll do with the alt-min tax. They don't do anything with the alt-min tax. I don't think this changes too many people's taxes.
Yeah, so, I mean, at maximum, the highest that people who are making more than $375,000 are with taxable income, they're probably making a lot more than that because they get to deduct all their deductions. It's still only 39.6%, which historically is a relatively low tax rate. In my lifetime, in all of our lifetimes, the marginal tax rate at one point was 90%.
I remember that. I remember that.
Yeah, and then it was reduced to 70%, and everybody thought that was wonderful. And then when President Reagan made really, really dramatic tax cuts, he lowered the maximum rate to 50%. And we're talking about a rate that's somewhat lower than that, significantly lower than that.
It's just, you know, it's hard to look at. And then there's other discussions that investment income would be subject to a Medicare tax.
Yeah. Well, probably the one change in the tax law that is most likely to affect some of our listeners is the change in the taxation of dividend income and capital gain income. Right now, the maximum rate of tax on dividend income or capital gain income is 15%, and next year, the maximum rate of tax on dividend income will be whatever your normal tax rate is. So if you're in the 25% tax bracket or 35% tax bracket, that is what your dividend income will be taxed at. Whatever your normal tax rate is. So the favorable treatment of dividend tax goes away. For capital gains, the maximum rate of tax on capital gains right now is 15%. At the end of this year, it is scheduled to go back up to 20%. And absent some statutory change, which nobody foresees at this time, there's a strong likelihood that the capital gains rate will go back up to 20%. So I guess the message to most of our listeners is if you have a possibility to realize a capital gain, if you have stocks that have gone up in value, if you're thinking of selling investment property and you're going to make a profit, it's probably better to do it in 2010 than to wait till 2011.
I see. What does this figure, you know, they're fighting about, they're going to raise taxes, the Bush tax cuts back in the early part of this century. They're going to keep... The Democrats are proposing they keep all but the $250,000 plus
right.
folks.
The Bush tax cuts are really the tax cuts that were enacted in 2001 and 2003. All of the provisions that were enacted then were scheduled to sunset or go out of existence at the end of 2010.
Right.
And President Obama says he's only going to allow that to happen for people who have incomes of above $250,000.
Right.
So the promise the president has made and consistently emphasized every time he's had a chance is that if the tax law does change, it's only going to affect people who have taxable income of more than $250,000.
So most feds and certainly retirees can probably breathe easy.
Yeah, most federal employees.
If that obtains.
Yeah, for most federal employees whose major source of their income is from their job, which it probably is for most individuals.
Yeah,
if they don't have a lot of inherited income or a lot of investment income, and their income's under $250,000, they don't need to get too terribly concerned. the one issue that I deal with all the time on behalf of federal employees, many federal employees or federal retirees have dividend income and capital gain income, and it's certainly better to realize that income and pay taxes on it this year than it would be to realize it and pay taxes on it next year.
One of the questions that we get in seminars frequently is, how does the, when you reach 70 and a half, how does the minimum tax work? I mean, you have to start drawing money out so the IRS can start getting some money, but it's very minimal, isn't it?
Well, yeah, there's a, when you reach 70 and a half, you've got to take what's known as a required minimum distribution. You've got to take out a minimum amount every year and pay taxes on. And when you reach age 70, what you do is you divide, you take whatever you have in all of your tax qualified plans, your IRAs, your 401ks, your thrift plans, and you divide that by 27.4. So you've got, you have to withdraw less than 4% of what you have in there.
That's what I've always heard, yeah.
And then when you do, when you withdraw that 4%, you report it as regular taxable income and pay taxes on it.
So, do you have clients that, when they reach 70 and a half, I think it's literally April 1st after the year you turn 70 and a half, will take the a monthly payment to equal the minimum distribution requirement and leave the rest invested?
Absolutely. And what one of the things, if you look at the table that the IRS puts out, you'll quickly realize that if you're earning 5% on your money in the thrift plan, and you leave it there, and you only withdraw the minimum amount, so you're taking money out every year, your account balance is going to continue to grow every year until you reach age 79. So in other words, you can still leave your money in the thrift plan or an IRA and let it grow tax-deferred and still use it as a tax shelter even after you reach 70 and a half.
And what's, you said 79, is that some magic
age? Well, no, if you look at the table, every year the amount you withdraw from the thrift plan, the percentage you have to take out increases as you get older. It's based loosely on your life expectancy. And until you reach age 79, you're always going to be taking out less than 5% of what you have in the plan.
And then post 79, it would be a higher.
Then it gets a little bit higher. And the other thing, the other number I've figured out that is if you're making 7.5% on your investment, and that's not an unreasonable investment assumption, your account balance. Well, it has been in recent years. But historically, a 7.5% rate of return had been thought of as a relatively conservative assumption. Now, in recent years, it hasn't been. Most investments haven't been returning anywhere near that.
Tom, isn't this true for traditional IRAs as well as the thrift?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah,
so the money minimum would have to come out of both.
Yeah, the minimum distribution rules apply to any tax deferred money you have, whether it's in an IRA, whether it's in a thrift plan, whether it may be in a 403B plan, which is kind of a 401K plan for people in the not-for-profit sector or people at educational institutions. Those rules apply to everybody. The only thing it doesn't apply to, and I'm sure both of you are aware of this, is your Roth IRA. Yeah, you can leave it in there forever.
Let me ask you this. Is there an age where all this money's got to be gone?
No. According to the IRS life expectancy tables, when you reach 115, you still got another 1.8 years left in life expectancy. So one of the good things, one of the really, for those of you who are feeling down and need to be cheered up a little bit, take a look at the IRS life expectancy tables. And if you do, you'll conclude that no matter how old you get, you're never going to die. You're still going to have some life expectancy left. So,
well, let's take a segue into estate planning. This is a perfect lead-in. If somebody did have a traditional IRA that would be otherwise taxable upon their death to the recipient, maybe not all at once, I don't want to get way out there, and or the TSP, what do they do with that money? Let's say they had their druthers and they'd like to take care of family and friends, but they also had a charitable desire. Let's just say that. Not everybody does. Should maybe that money go to the charity that's in the taxable account, like the traditional IRA or the thrift, or some of that money?
Well, for people who are charitably inclined and have money which is in a tax-deferred plan like the thrift or an IRA, it makes eminent sense to use that money in the thrift plan to satisfy their charitable desires. And the reason for that, let me just give you a very simple example. If you've got $10,000 in the thrift plan and you leave it to your children, they're going to pay tax on that money when they withdraw it. So let's say they're in the 30% combined state-federal tax bracket. If they get $10,000, they're going to have to pay $3,000 in income tax. If you leave it to your favorite charity and you leave them $10,000, they don't pay taxes on it because they're tax exempt. So they get to use the full $10,000. So for anybody who, number one, wants to make a gift to charity at the time they die, and number two, has money in a tax-deferred account, it makes sense to use that tax-deferred money to satisfy your charitable desires.
Yeah. And I'm not so sure people recognize that. But they should, because after they come talk to you, they would.
Well, it's something that charitable organizations certainly try to publicize. That as a matter of fact, a number of years ago, I did some work for a charitable organization, and they wanted to get that message out to people that, hey, look, if you're going to make us a gift, that's a good place to make it from. Now, the bad part about that is you got to die to be able to do that. You can't do that right now. If let's say you want to give $10,000 to your favorite charity, and you want to pull that money out of the thrift plan, well, you can do that. You pull it out of the thrift plan, but it's subject to tax, and then you can give it to your favorite charity, and you get a deduction, and hopefully it'll wash, but it doesn't necessarily always work that way.
All right, Tom, I apologize for this, but how does somebody get in touch with you to pick up on these learned topics?
Well, probably the best way is just to give me a phone call, and my phone number is 301-517-4821, and that's my direct dial number at my office.
You are a brave man.
Yeah.
But he's just coming back from vacation.
As a matter of fact, I was at my office, but I didn't change my voicemail message. So if anybody calls me now, they're going to get a message telling them that I'm out of the office and I won't be back until today.
All righty, let's... we talk about estate taxes just a little bit there, but what's the story with estate taxes in 2011?
Well, right now, the estate taxes are in a very confusing state. As we speak, there is no federal estate tax. If you had the good fortune or misfortune to pass away this year, your estate will not be subject to tax. When George Steinbrenner died and owned the New York Yankees, it's are worth something like $1.5 billion. Under current estate tax law, he pays no estate tax. If the law stays as it is, and Mr. Steinbrenner had passed away in 2011, his heirs would have had to pay an estate tax of somewhere around $750 million on the Yankees alone. Wow. Right now, there is no federal estate tax. The way the law currently reads, the estate tax comes back into existence on January 1st of 2011, and anything in excess of $1 million is subject to estate tax at a rate that can be as high as 55%. Now, there's been a lot of talk and a lot of expectation that Congress is going to change that before January 1st of 2011, but as we are speaking today, it hasn't changed.
All right. A lot of people, when they hear those numbers, and those numbers are large.
They're very large.
And they go, what difference does that make to me? But what about state estate tax?
Well, for listeners who live in many states, including locally in either Maryland or the District of Columbia, if you have assets of more than $1 million, you're subject to state estate tax. Maryland also has an inheritance tax. And if you leave your assets to anybody other than your spouse, your children, grandchildren, or your siblings, in Maryland, they also pay a 10% inheritance tax on any inheritance at all. So those are other things you need to be concerned about. For local listeners in the local area, if you live in Virginia, Virginia eliminated its estate tax altogether several years ago. And still, $1 million is a huge amount of money. But for people who live around the Washington Beltway, if you own a home and you've lived in this area for any length of time, you may be well on your way to having a $1 million estate.
Yeah. It's not that hard as you might think.
And the other thing people need to think about is it's not $1 million in net worth. It's $1 million in gross level of assets. So if you've got life insurance, if you've got Fegley life insurance, it's not worth anything while you're alive. But when you die, if you got $200,000 or $300,000 in life insurance, that's taxable in your estate. So I regularly deal with people who certainly don't think of themselves as being wealthy. But when you add in things like their home, their car, their bank accounts, the furnishings in their home, their life insurance, their 401k, their retirement, many, many times they'll see that they're in a position where they could be faced with an estate tax liability.
Yeah, I think where I'm confused about life insurance, you know, sometimes you hear from, oh, there's this guy on NPR or public television that says, well, way to shelter your income from estate taxes is through life insurance. But you're saying life insurance gets lumped in and is subject to the estate tax.
Well, it can be.
That's one of the things that drives people crazy about taxes.
I'm
glad Tom's here for that one, John.
Yeah. I once listened to a guy giving a lecture on taxes, and he said, I can answer every question you have, and I can tell you the answer right now. It's always, it depends. Yeah. That's the way it is with life insurance. First, life insurance proceeds are not subject to income tax. So when you die, your heirs, whoever you've named as beneficiary of your life insurance, receives that life insurance and does not pay income tax on it. From an estate tax perspective, in most cases, life insurance is taxable as part of their estate unless they have assigned away ownership of that policy. They've transferred ownership to another person or to a trust. So in doing estate planning, you can structure your estate so that life insurance is not taxable.
So people should be seeing somebody like you to structure it so it won't be. Life insurance won't be taxable, for instance.
That certainly is advisable. For people who, when you lump in your life insurance with everything else you have, if you have an estate tax liability, you need to take some steps to minimize or avoid that estate tax liability. And it really is not terribly difficult to do, but you need to do it. And many people just say, well, you know, I'm not worth $1 million. And then I say, how much life insurance do you have? And they'll say, well, you know, I got young kids, so I got $2 million worth of life insurance.
Uh-huh.
And if the law changes and you die after 2011 and there's only $1 million that's exempt from tax, you're going to lose roughly 1/4 of that $2 million in life insurance to taxes. So I guess probably the best advice we can give anybody with respect to estate taxes is let's watch what happens between now and the end of the year. If nothing happens, if the federal estate tax exemption drops back to $1 million, most people who listen to this program probably need to take a look at their own estate tax picture and see what they can do to minimize liability.
That's good advice, and I'm sure some people, myself maybe a little included, are scratching their head. What did all that mean? This program is archived, and you could listen to it again, or we're coming to a town near you, or we're certainly doing a lot of seminars in the Metro D.C. area, and Tom teaches a fair amount of them. And so avail yourself, even if it's not NITP, although I thought we were the only retirement seminar firm in the country, but I understand there are others. Avail yourself at your agency's retirement seminar, and you'll probably hear people talk about this.
Yeah. There are a lot of opportunities to learn a lot about the estate tax.
Yeah.
Okay, so but we've covered some medium duty, light duty, but a lot of heavy duty subjects. What we didn't talk about, although I had to run out for a coughing break a minute ago,
hay fever season?
Yeah, oh, I had this bug last week, and it's the last vestiges of it. Go away, bug. Anyway, did we talk about IRS audits?
No, we didn't.
All right, and we're talking the individual, maybe small business level, but let's talk individual level. And I don't mean any disrespect to the IRS. And in fact, as a taxpayer in my quietest moment, I like it. It puts the fear of whomever back out on the streets. Last 20 years, the very few audits Congress didn't appropriate funds for IRS auditors. People didn't have the respect that they should. They usually didn't necessarily want to deal with them if they were way out there. But you see a lot of people in a normal situation. I'm not talking about the above average taxpayer. Somebody with a small business that swears it's a small business, but it loses money every year. That is a hot button for them. Hot button for them. And so I'm not saying you're going to get audited if you do it, but you have to measure the tax savings versus the aggravation level if you get audited. Because if you do get audited, they're not bad people. They're not out to fry you. Generally, I would say they're more agreeable than not. But if they come in for one thing, they're not staying with that one. They're going after other things that may be on the return of interest to them. So if you have a very small business and it's losing $1,000 or $2,000 and you feel very good about this, the tax savings might be $500 or $600. The aggravation level, if you get audited, will be a multiple of that.
Absolutely. And the first question people in the IRS always ask, if you're in business and you're losing money, why are you doing it? Who goes into business to lose money?
At the seminars, you know, everybody's got this. I can do this for 3 years. Well, yeah, you can. There's this law. It's called Hobby Loss Rule, I think, Tom.
Yep, that's what it's called. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean everybody gets to lose money for 3 years.
That's right. I mean, no, there's certain presumptions if you lose money only for 3 years, but it doesn't necessarily say IRS can't disallow those losses if your purpose was to engage in a hobby, or IRS says any activity engaged in for not for profit, if your goal is not to make a profit.
Yeah.
And that happens. And many times those activities tend to be things that people consider to be fun. You know, like, you know, you have a boat and you're using the boat and say, I'm leasing it out. Or some people who maybe are painting or making ceramics and selling them and always losing money. Or you're a writer and you're getting started in your career as a writer because you're going to write the next major bestseller. And you continue to write off your expenses. IRS tends to look askance at those things and does question them.
Years ago, there was a court case, and it's funny now, and this individual, I think it was a married couple, but it doesn't make any difference, married or not, and they traveled the world to perfect the perfect steak. And they wrote off their travel expenses in researching the different areas and what made a perfect steak. And they came back and wrote the book and deducted all the expenses up front, and IRS said, I don't think so, and they got nailed. They have other ways to treat that now, and I just assume not go in it way beyond today's show. But it just, you know, I lost a client years ago. They did exactly what Tom said. They wanted to be a travel agent so that they should first visit these places, and then they could be knowledgeable of it, and or they could write an article for Travel and Leisure, which never buys any articles from folks like these. And they got mad at me, and I said, you can't do that. You're just asking for trouble. I said, if you get in trouble, I could get in trouble. I could prepare a penalty if I do things that I should know better than to do. And I don't know where they are now, but I know where they're not.
Well, I guess the watchword is don't hesitate to claim legitimate deductions, but make sure you can support them. And if you have a business and you consistently lose money, in all likelihood, the IRS is going to question that.
Yeah, I had somebody not long ago, he had a small loss in his little business, but he made a lot of money on other things. I mean, a lot of money. They still denied the loss, even though it was directly related to the income producing of the other things. So I think we're getting the high sign here, the real high sign. So, Tom, final comments?
Well, I thank you for having me again. Keep abreast of what's happening between now and the end of the year in Congress, because changes may be ahead in the tax law.
Okay. John?
Review your will periodically and make sure you're...